he sends me a selfie like later that night of him wearing a King's K shirt, about to go on stage at Creation. And so I was like, oh, dude, what are you doing? You cannot do that right now. And later after the show, he called me. He said that as he was walking on stage, the stage manager like grabbed him and said, if you say anything about King's Kaleidoscope, we'll cut the power to your set.
Welcome back to Labeled. I'm your host, Matt Carter, and today we've got a convo with Chad Gardner of King's Kaleidoscope. Now, Chad's somebody I've been close with for well over a decade. We were at Mars Hill Church together, and ever since he left there, I've been helping him to navigate his career in various capacities, from helping him to self-release their first EP, to facilitating the deal with them to be on Tooth & Nail, and promoting them to the Bad Christian Podcast. And I've been working as advisor or manager in some capacity ever since. And what intrigues me most about Chad is that he's the most efficient, high-level, and high-energy problem solver I've encountered in this business. And he fits a pattern that we see over and over again in this world and on this podcast of kids who come from families that have an engineering and technical talent and use that to power high-level creativity and art. And Chad's ability to lead creative teams and react and improvise is what leads to the aesthetic and musical excellence that King's Kaleidoscope is known for. They're also known for having a rebellious spirit from within the Christian music and worship world, pushing boundaries and an extremely DIY approach to everything. And King's has a new self-titled album out tonight, so go listen on Spotify, and also a full U.S. tour starting this week. So go to kingskaleidoscope.com, find your city, and get your tickets. All right, let's do this. I find myself moving with the wrong voices. Comment on this podcast is kids couldn't sit still in school, learn their own way, do things different, have engineer parents, don't quite fit in, and that pacing and sitting still in school is a common starting place for people. Is that you?
I could sit still in school, but I, the thing that didn't work for me with school was just like the anxiousness, you know, like, I mean the high level story is I got kicked out of high school after my sophomore year because I was just skipping so much school because I had so much anxiety. So if I sat in the back of the class and I was like feeling like I was gonna have a panic attack, I just wouldn't go to the next class. I would just skip school. So I did that so much that I had to transfer high schools. But as a little kid, I was actually okay. Like I did, I had pretty good grades, elementary school, middle school, same thing. I only started having bad grades if I had like, was having panic attacks and stuff, and I would just kind of check out.
And you don't think that is at all related to the environment itself, not being like, you know, there's some environment where you might have thrived better than that one.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't go to kindergarten or first grade because my mom just told me, or the way she tells it is just, I was just told her no. I just told her like, I'm not going to school. I grew up like in around a bunch of woods, and she was like, all right, well, I guess I'm gonna homeschool you. So whatever that was, I don't know, what do you homeschool a kindergarten or first grader, you know? Mm-hmm. I'd already learned how to read, so I just was playing and was trying to make me do math and stuff. But
well, everybody seems to have their own version of how they didn't interface with what just was seen as normal in their environment. But so you kind of represent some of the homeschool. Like, I think one thing about you that is very fascinating is a lot of people's childhoods around, especially around the religious upbringing and stuff like that, there's a lot of negativity to it in a way. And you're somebody who had a very religious upbringing in a way that seems to be less negative, and that sticks out, you know what I mean, when like in that way. But so there's somehow where your autonomy and homeschool and you know, like you said, saying no to going to school, that kind of like, that seems a little bit not the standard story.
Yeah, I don't have a story of like, and church really messed me up. It just didn't. It was just good.
But very close knit, very religious, and but was it control? Like in some way, you had the thing that people typically say is that environment was too small and controlling and limiting. But you seem to have had some autonomy in that, or some way to
no, I mean
express beyond that.
Yeah, I think church was actually the free sort of space or like fertile soil to just be really creative. So, you know, my parents were always like in the lead, helping lead worship or whatever. My mom sang, my dad played guitar. So the earliest, when I'm 3, 4, 5 years old, I'm just running around the whole building playing with my friends while they're rehearsing in the sanctuary, and I'm hearing music. And then I joined the kids choir where I'm, you know, I got in trouble and stuff like that, but I was like getting to sing and be in a choir, and that didn't feel restrictive or anything like that. And then in middle school, I was, you know, playing for a youth group like so many kids do, but that felt exciting for me. That didn't feel small. It felt like I could be really creative and, you know, and my bands, like in high school that were just at the school, we would like rehearse at the church. We could use any of the equipment whenever we wanted to. And then, I just had a ton of, it just felt like it was the community hub for me to bring any musician I wanted to, and we could just play music and record with my gear. And it was just, it was more of like a free open space that allowed us to just test stuff, try stuff, cut our teeth.
Mm-hmm. Her church is definitely the farm system for the music of the
world.
It
was a farm system, but there was less pressure because it wasn't a mega church. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't also just 50 people. It was a big enough, literally like it was a big enough building and space where I could just commandeer a room and just have my band practice in it, and nobody cared. It was just, you know.
So you didn't bump in, I mean, the puzzle is you're one of the most rebellious people I know. Yeah, so yeah. So you go through this childhood in that system without rebelling against it somehow. And you have, like you described the anxiety thing, you also probably feel, I mean, you also have one of the higher levels of anxiety as a person of anybody. Don't you think? And that's still with you today, and you've always kind of had that. So the interplay of all those things are interesting.
Well, the rebellious thing was just that, like, you know, I had the, if you have a contrarian personality like I do, there's like a healthy way to use it and an unhealthy way and probably a lot of gray. So the gray all growing up was that, you know, CCM was the bad guy, and it was exploitive and it was uncreative and the music was really bad. And, you know, Chris Tomlin and David Crowder and Hillsong are like the enemy. So which is like silly to say now, but I also understand that that's how a lot of people feel. And so as like 14, 15, 16 year old, 17, like all grown up, that version of me was using the available space of the church that I had, that was in a sense nurturing me to just try whatever, to make music, make worship music and lead worship in ways that was not going to be that. It would just like, go for it, whatever you want to do, you know? So I did a lot of really like cringy stuff. I mean, I used to sing and scratch like turntables at the same time with the band, like playing for Sunday worship.
And what age?
Oh, that's probably like 17.
So you're doing
like this— I'm a DJ, and that's how I'm learning how to make music, and I'm DJing weddings and all my like, you know, middle school dances and all that stuff. And then I'm just like, well, why don't I just do that at church? So we'll just arrange this hymn or whatever, and I'll just DJ it and also build the band behind me, and I'll do that on the stage. And the church had no problem with it. Which that, I think that's the rare thing. I think a lot of people's church and religious systems are you know, they're just, they just, they have so much tradition they have to hold on to. But the church I grew up at was really encouraging for me to try stuff, which, I mean, made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this was your obsession when you were a teenager?
Yep. Yep. That's the rebelliousness.
And yeah. And how could you articulate it then or differently now, either one of those? But how would you articulate that obsession? You didn't maybe realize you'd be here today still obsessed with the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'm obsessed with the same thing, to be honest. I think it's happened. I think, the North Star that you quickly found when I was in high school was like, oh shit, there's Marcel Church in Ballard in Seattle that's basically kind of doing this already. Oh my gosh, same DNA. All these guys are older. They're working on Death Cab Records and all this stuff, you know, like, and I started to look up to them and was sort of copying that and just visiting. Like, I'd visit once a month or just drive into the city.
What did you think you're doing when you were 16, though? If somebody said, man, you're not into school that much or whatever, like it would have been, it's like, what were your attention and focus was on this, DJing, PA systems,
music. Just making music. Just making music.
Yeah.
It was the escape, you know. Well, it was the escape. The only reason I wasn't into school is because I had, you know, the insecurity of like, well, am I going to feel good today or am I going to be having like a panic attack? And the most distracting thing for that was just going home and just making beats all day, sampling, bringing people over, and just jamming.
So is it the creating and collaborating? Was it one more than the other? But that's the pattern: is create, collaborate.
Yeah, it's
you
both.
You need other people for it.
It's both.
You
have. I definitely would just sit for hours in my own room and just make beats and learn how to, you know, I was making beats on like Acid and a Roland 4-track and all that stuff. And, but then, like I keep saying, but the church space was where I could bring all these other people and we could actually like make bands.
And get the feedback. Like, so you sit in your room, yep. You make something, and then mm-hmm. you need reactions from other people. And then you need to try it on a group and then and change it again and keep
sure.
going.
Yeah, it's just trying stuff on. But yeah, I guess the way to like wrap this section is just that the environment that I grew up in with church and with my parents was just encouraging to experiment with art. Mm-hmm. And that was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad had this thing, which was like, any piece of music gear you want, I'll pay half. So, you know, if I wanted a new turntable or whatever, he would pay half and I'd, you know, bust down a guitar center and pick it up. And that was awesome.
Yeah.
You know,
now that's the ideal type of environment to create.
Right. Like if you're going to be investing in it, you can mow the lawn a bunch of times and go out and buy this guitar and I'll pay half for it.
So that you can, you know, but you're motivated to your own self-directed
interest, thing. Whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And so over time are going to see if that changes or you don't see that as still what you do today.
I don't know. I just know that I know that the extent that I like demonize like the commercialism of like Christian art, I still think that it's like weird, but I just know that like nobody's all bad anymore because I'm an adult now, you know? So it's like, no, a lot of those songs are real. Like Joel Houston wasn't like trying to write songs just for money. Like that's a thing a 13-year-old thinks. You know, that's not real. Mm-hmm. But yeah, whatever that energy was definitely made me try to like push the limits of art as much as I could. And then going into Mars Hill, it was the same thing. It was like all arranged music for a Sunday morning that is uncopyable. One thing I thought a lot about was like, I'm going to try to make this non-franchisable. Like you can't, King's Kaleidoscope cannot be played anywhere else in the world because it's a real band. And yeah, you can have a U2 cover band, but it's kind of dumb. And I wanted it to feel like that. Like we are a real band that plays only here in Seattle for these people. And we're going to give it our all. And that is sort of giving it your all was why it felt special to me. It was sort of like, It's like that Larry Norman, like, why should the devil have all the good music thing? It's like, but especially with the church music. But I understand the franchise model. I understand why it's like most churches, you want to get a lot of people involved. And mm-hmm. it makes sense. And I think it's a good model. I just want it to be the most like boutique thing possible that yeah. was the opposite of that.
Right. And I will spare everybody, we'll do everybody a favor and skip over the whole Mars Hill as a category of thing. Mm-hmm. But we go from right here, it makes sense how you got into Mars Hill yeah. And did that for what years would that have been?
I got hired, 20. No, right when I turned 21, I started leading worship there. And then I led there till I was 25, I think. Yeah, 25.
So there for 4 or 5 years, and then you become a tooth and nail artist. So let's just jump in there and just what do you remember and how did that occur from your point of view?
Well, I left the church with like half a record done. Actually with most of a record done. And it would have gone out on that label. But the church was collapsing. So basically I was working on a record at the church, but then left. And then had this, you know, really big record. It was like 17 or 18 songs. And Tooth and Nail, sort of, they were the ones that like inherited all the church projects. And so it kind of made the most sense to try it out and go with them. Because the church was no longer. So, yeah, they bought out Mars Hill Music. And so it kind of made sense that they would have our first record along with all the EPs we did at the church.
Yeah, so they wound up getting the rights to the IP that you created while you were at the church.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, so you're a worship band at Mars Hill Church.
Yep.
And then that falls apart.
Right.
So what happened, how do you remember it happening that you, you know, leave the church and start doing, you know, it's like you have this trajectory. It's one of the more rare ones out there where you are a worship band first and an mm-hmm. actual worship band
right.
and then become I don't know what even words to use to describe it, but not a church band, basically. That's a rare path.
Yeah. To be honest, it just felt like at that time, because we had made a record already, most of a record while I was at the church, and then I left, it just felt like kind of dumb to not put it out. So it was legitimately like a one record at a time thing. It was like, we have this huge record of 18 songs. We just got to get it out. It'll feel really good to put it out. So we put it out. We don't really know what's going to happen. And then it goes good enough that then 2 years later, we put out another one. And it was just a snowball. Like as a kid, I just dreamed about being a producer and you know, producing other people's records or making my own stuff. But it was never like, I'm going to be an artist. It was like, I'm going to be a producer. And then it was, oh, I'm going to try to change like what happens with Christian music in America. And then after I honestly, I mean, it might just sound, I mean, I don't think it's proud, but I felt like I had accomplished that with the influence of what Mars Hill did for that time. Mm-hmm. So I almost got like all those, what we're talking about, like the adolescent sort of aggro like dreams. I kind of felt like I had done them by the time I was like 24, even though I didn't have big records in the music industry. I felt like what King's Kaleidoscope was doing at church was already doing what I had wanted it to do, which was just influence like a tip of the spear way of doing things that was very different.
Yeah, well, that's what I always thought was crazy about it was that being like, I was out touring in vans and had done this thing, and it's like, well, the path to being a band is you make $100 a night, you do a million shows, and then whatever, maybe you can sell some records or something.
Yeah.
What I'm observing is that you're just a church band playing Sundays at church, but the church itself becomes this media distribution thing.
Center, yeah.
So it was kind of clear to me. It was like, but yeah. everywhere I would go, people would know who you were, and you hadn't been anywhere yet. That was the, right, it's like, if I go to Florida, people know who King's Kaleidoscope is, but you hadn't even been anywhere or done, you know, it was just, and so it was interesting that, you know, you had this value. Really, it was globally. Like, you had a, it was like, that's what I felt was odd. It's like, this band has a global fan base and hadn't been anywhere yet.
Well, it was a global, I mean, that the church was a global, for sure, influence and voice that, you know, we just got, that honestly just got to take on sort of more, or we got, it got to be the distribution for sort of the, yeah, kind of the art and the attitude and the character that we were trying to like push.
Yeah. So Tooth and Nail has this side of them that does worship music and BEC and that Christian stuff. And that makes sense. But King's Kaleidoscope somehow different as they fit into Tooth and Nail side, where it almost was like a punk band.
Right.
In, but yet, you know, so that's the thing. It's like your spirit is like a punk, contrarian. You call it contrarian, we call it punk.
Right, it is punk. But yeah, I mean, that's like,
But it's not the CCM,
no,
obviously.
We're never opening for Jeremy Camp.
Yeah, so then you're getting released by Tooth and Nail in this kind of other stream. It's like this other stream. So I'm curious how do you felt about that?
I mean, I loved it. I think... Yeah, I wonder if you could all... It's so funny because musically, King's Kaleidoscope is so, you know, maximalist and like in like enchanting and all... It's all these things, but it is like a punk worship band, basically, which is almost why it makes sense on the Tooth and Nail side. And I even think just like as an idea, worship music is the most uncool thing you could do. So even doing it like full force in itself is almost punk. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
Well, that's what it felt like, especially if you go rent. So you started then doing the venues in town. Like the, you
that
know,
was
like, that was a
punk.
Huge, huge moment where it's like, there's this band at church and then they're going and renting the Crocodile or Numos or whatever. Yep. And it's like, wait, these are the rock clubs.
Yeah.
And it's bringing, what is this? Like that was a unique thing. So I've never seen, you know, that's a rare thing. What do you remember about that?
I just remember each one of those actually at the time felt like a big deal. It did feel like, all right, we have a, you know, not even big, like we have a Numos is 650 cap. We have a real venue for a real show. Are we a real band? Like it,
yeah.
it felt just crazy. Cause you know, I wasn't playing shows when I was 17 and 18 and all that stuff where you just come up and that's what a band does. It was more, no, I'm playing at church and maybe there's 1,000 people in the room, but it's church. It's totally different. And just selling a couple hundred tickets at a club felt like a bigger deal. It felt more nerve-wracking for me. But...
Well, I mean, the tickets are, so, you know what I mean? Instead of being free and for
it's
all
free,
the whole...
It's free. It's ticketed. It's like kind of confusing. But I think that, you know, it's clear, like... We did a couple of those shows before we ever released the first record. But then I remember the first record, you were there. We Becoming Who We Are, we had a release party at the Crocodile, which is like, you know, got a lot of history. It's a venue in Seattle, like Nirvana and all these bands have always played there. And we played it. Our record release on a Monday night, and we played it. We sold out the club on a Monday night. And, you know, it's 500-something people. And the energy... is so different than church because it's people who all are there specifically for your music. It means something to them. They paid money to be there. And it's a completely different energy than the church. It's a different aim too, sort of. But yeah, the church thing where I would be like, all right, the melody is going to stay this way so that a 7 to 70-year-old can sing it, but we'll make the music around the melody nuts. Then all of a sudden we could just do literally whatever we wanted to. and people would like it even more. or I would just say participate even more.
At a totally different level.
Different level to even more expressive to me personal music, because I understand that, like, I'm going to service this church service gathering where I'm going to make it that everybody can sing along with me. But that's using my, you know, vocal ability or range or whatever in a limited way. And then when I could go unlimited with my range and my energy and people would participate more.
Yeah.
And I was still doing it with a very worshipful spirit and really as a worship leader in a way. Like, we're not just here to entertain people. This isn't just a rock band all of a sudden. We're still singing all songs about faith. We're doing it from a spirit of worship, but everybody's matching our intensity. Mm-hmm. That feels amazing.
The cap is off. The faders can go all the way up. The lights are out. There's a bar here, even though nobody's drinking.
Nobody's drinking, but, and they always hate it.
But they're singing. It's the recklessness. The thing that's fun about rock, aggressive, loud. You can yell. You can scream. The really open, like that. And then the audience feels a lot more uninhibited in that environment, too.
Yep.
So that was like an unlock of something that was already developed.
Yeah.
So it felt to me like you just stepped from this church environment straight into what every rock band considers fully successful, like selling out venues, like having ticket, like
it's
without even in it, you just stepped right out and it was just already formed into a what felt like an instant success is the way it looked.
Yeah,
like.
We basically had no sort of like just bumming around tours. I mean, we did. These were all like sprinter tours the first couple years, but yeah, we were playing, you know, good medium sized rooms and selling a bunch of them out. And
it's right not. There's it. Other worship bands and they can play, you know, secular venues, whatever it is. But it's not like your show at Chain Reaction. Like, you play Chain Reaction in a way that belongs at Chain Reaction.
That
is different.
Well, and that's the music though, and that's the aggressiveness. That's the that's that punk worship thing that sounds so funny to say, but it's really true. It's just that is our niche, is like full musical expression, full faith all the time. You don't like compromise on either of those. Mm-hmm. As a band, when we were playing at church, we would definitely like tone down the musicality sometimes, even though but I would push it as hard as I possibly could, you know. But yeah,
there's a clip at Chain Reaction of you guys playing Prayer. It's such a punk feel to it, because you feel it, you're in, it's this really heavy song and you're in Chain Reaction, it's all this stuff, and then you get to the part and there's a break where you just make them sit in silence. Jesus, where are you? And it is so long. Like, it seems like there's something wrong or it's been edited if you watch it on the video.
We used to push it as long as we could.
It's insane. And it's you've created this moment. It's like nobody, after listening to the first half of that song, is making a peep sound. No chatter in the background, nothing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you get the whole room to be totally quiet, and then you hold them there for way too long. Like, it's like, how uncomfortable is this going to get? And then it explodes.
Listen, we used to do this thing. When we were playing that song, like every show, we would do this thing where if somebody did say something, we would hold it longer. So like, you know, and it, I mean, like, they weren't trying, but somebody would say like, I don't know, they would just shout something out in the middle to like break it. Mm-hmm. And then we would just make it go longer.
Yeah, that's what you feel. That it's moment. All up it's like to Brian on the violin. Something dirty or something.
Yeah, it was just whoever was the audio Brian on the violin when because that's what happens when the song comes back in with the violin line. It was on them to just, we would all just hold.
That song is just a real, you know, that's a big piece, I guess, of the whole history. That song, you know, I remember before when you were making that song, through it coming out and through it getting played live and everything. But how do you think of that song, its whole history? That's on your second Tooth & Nail release,
I mean, that's on the second Tooth & Nail release. I mean, so like that first record, I only wrote like, I don't know, 3 or 4 songs on it. It's out of 17. Mm-hmm. The other ones were all co-writes, were mostly other people writing lyrics, or I was just rearranging hymns. So really the second record was me, the thing that felt very daunting to me at the time was, you know, well, I had this record come out and it like worked. Well, shit, like, do I have to become a songwriter now? Like, I'm 26, I've never written songs before. That's not something I did in high school. I just produced, I rearranged music for church. I took other people's lyrics and made songs out of it. Well, now I have to have like a voice. And so a lot of those songs were sort of grueling and like, I'm really trying to like find my poetic voice and co-writing with my friend Zach. But that one is the only one that just sort of like happened. There was no like writing. There was no like, you know, freaking trying to think of the syllables or the consonants or like, I get pretty technical when I write lyrics. That song just was sort of like 100% emotion, you know, 1 or 2 takes. And then on the first half, and then where that silence is, I didn't know how to finish the song at all. And then I remember like it was too heavy for me to touch the song without like basically crying. And then 3 days later, or it was 2 or 3 days, I had to wait. And then I came back to it. And within like 20 minutes, the whole ending of the song, I just had it like right off the top of my head. And I sang it in like 2 takes, maybe 1 take. And then that's just what the record is. And I haven't really had a song like that since. So all I'm saying is, in the canon of all the songs, to me, that song feels like one of the purest, just, it's an emotional dump, mm-hmm. and it's not thought out, and it just is what it is, and it's very sort of pure. And so yeah, I'm proud of it.
When, you know, then there's the controversy part of that, just with the like, for all that is, that song actually had controversy all the way across from within the band to out to Creation Fest and all that. So I'm just, that stuff's fascinating, if you don't mind walking through.
Yeah, I mean, basically it's like, so you have this thing that feels very pure, like I just said. And then, you know, the audience, or you know that the market isn't going to respond well to it in the pure form. So what we had this huge dilemma of like, do we release it as it is in that 1 take version, or should we alter it? And
that has to do with the fact that there's a cuss word in it.
Yeah,
took part totally. Of that. So that came out, and how did that even come in? That you say you did in 2 takes. Was it thought through? You didn't jot that down on paper and wrestle with it?
I had a journal entry where I had basically said close to that line, and so then I just sang it, and it was right. And I remember showing it to the band before I could write the second half, because I didn't know, and they were like, wow, that's so, they felt for it for what it was. Like, that's really heavy and really good. But it was like a joke. It was like, well, we can never do this, so what are we going to do with it? But then after I finished the song in the second half, everybody sort of felt like, well, shoot, what are we going to do now? Because this is a very powerful thing. And how does integrity play into this? And then how does also being sensitive to other people's belief play into this, you know? So basically, like so many things in my life, I have this reoccurring belief that it's just both. It's like both and is usually the answer. So I made a clean one and I made the unedited one, and we put out both versions. And guess which version everybody listens to? The unedited version.
But there was talk of not putting out, but the clean version.
There was. We had to think about that hard, but we decided to go. And
the band wasn't even unanimous on that or anything.
Well, no, they weren't unanimous on it, but that also, it wasn't like big drama or anything, but that's coinciding with, you got this group of people that are church volunteers, mm-hmm. that, you know, make a record together, sort of. I mean, I made most of it, but they definitely helped and put a lot of energy into it over those years of arranging those at church or whatever. And then I go to the studio, I re-record it, they come play. And then we put it out, and, you know, there's like 10 people coming in out of the band at that point. They weren't all going to go have a career in music. So there was that slow trickle where they're like, oh, we're trying to accommodate 10 people to like, if we can go play like a conference or something in, you know, Iowa. as like the only show we're going to play this 6 months or something, because we're a real tooth and nail band now and we could never really do it. So all that to say, I think about half that group was already going to be on the way out, not even in a bad way, just in like a, wow, this is really cool. Yeah. We got to be a part of this. But then, yeah, but then we put it out and there was definitely, I think, I don't know off the top of my head, but there was at least one person that was like, I just don't want to play anymore if we're going to like play that song. You know, like if we're playing that song, like I don't want to play the show. And it was like, well, I'm sorry. Like we're going to be playing that song probably every show because it's like a really big record, or, you know, for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But once again, it wasn't like hard feelings. It was just sort of like, I totally respect that, but this is like what it is, you know? Yeah. And, you know, I didn't want to be in those. Like we'd have at that time too, we'd have a lot of conferences that would be like, or festivals. Like if you can, you know, just don't play that song or play the edited version. And I don't even like make fun of that. I don't have like, I'd get it. Like, well, yeah, we're going to go play a youth festival for a bunch of 13-year-olds, like, that's fine.
I mean, there's tons of places where they just say, there's a rule there that says no cussing on stage. Yeah, it's like, there's places we used to play, it's like, you can't cuss.
Which doesn't actually offend, so it doesn't offend me. It does. It's not something, I don't have, like, this, I didn't, like, pick up this flag of, like, we're going to be, like, I'm just into that. Like, this is kind of dumb to me. I totally respect it. So that's why it's silly that, like, Lifeway or all these places had to pull us. Completely, even though I'm pretty respectful of like all sides of it.
But the thing that bothered me was when, if you give both choices, then you should be able to do one choice or the other, but the disqualifying of your band because of something else you did for that was set, you know, disqualifying of the band, even though you offered the other version and wouldn't play it, or would play a clean version if you went somewhere, but them still using that to disqualify you. Yeah, that's the thing that strikes people as wrong.
And that was probably mostly felt through like Lifeway saying, we're not going to sell your CDs, or like Premier Productions, which runs like Winter Jam, saying we'll never work with King's Kaleidoscope, or like
Creation. And it wasn't like you were saying, yeah, because I'm going to come there and I'm going to do this song and I'm going to do that version. Not the case.
Never. Not even. They wouldn't even ask. Or like Creation, same thing. Creation Fest, like dropping us.
Yeah, that's its own whole micro story, I guess. Right? That
was my gosh. That was here's a good little thing. I don't think we could ever get in trouble for this anymore because they're not a thing anymore. But are they? They're done, right?
Yeah. They've...
So Andy Mineo, my friend, is a good friend, and he had been working with me. Or he came to Seattle so I could work on some music for him. And then we were both going to be like riding to Creation together because we're both going to play. But then they cut us, you know? So he's at
how long out was it?
Probably a couple weeks. You
booked for a long time, had real money.
Yeah.
And then contract, all that. The song came out, or it had been out for a while?
And then they were like, we're not going to have you play. So
even though it's not on the set list.
Even though it's not on the set list. And so Andy, you know, I just remember him being in my basement, and he's about to like leave. Whatever, somebody's picking him up. He's riding down there for King and Country or something like that. And I'm like giving him a bunch of merch, of King's merch to just take home just so he can have it. And so he took a bunch of stuff, and then he sends me a selfie like later that night of him wearing a King's K shirt, about to go on stage at Creation. And so I was like, oh, dude, what are you doing? You cannot do that right now. And later after the show, he called me. He said that as he was walking on stage, the stage manager like grabbed him and said, if you say anything about King's Kaleidoscope, we'll cut the power to your set. Like, crazy. It was that big of a deal for them, which I just can't believe that it was that big of a deal for this little dying niche Christian festival. Like, what? Who?
That's the thing that just rubs.
Who cares?
That's the thing that seems like it rubs the worst against the spirit of DIY punk or whatever. It's like, it feels like an image control at such a high degree with the church that can get, when it gets screwed up, it's like so much image control that it just feels obviously, like it feels obviously wrong to be that caught up in how you present.
Right.
And then, because it typically means there's stuff that isn't the way it is presented, and Creation Festival is a good example of that.
Right.
Because they had plenty of problems, and that wasn't them.
No, that was not one of their problems. Us going up and not even playing that song was not their problem at all. And then, man, the other thing was, Then we just had to hound them for a couple months to pay us because their contract, like, it was like, well, you all canceled on us. We were going to show up and not break any of your rules. So yeah. We got our money, though.
Yeah, that's right.
Which wasn't very much at the time. But I remember that was like a thing. It was like the easiest show we'd ever played because we didn't have to play and we still got the money.
So, you know, that then you've done touring and festivals and all this stuff, and you've started to, you've had the whole second era here where you're just, you are an external real band that all of a sudden people know you, and it's really, everything's not necessarily corrected to be in a church band anymore. Like, you're in the midst of a real career now.
Yeah, I mean, I really, from that second Tooth and Nail record on, there wasn't any songs that would be, you know, easily sung at a church service with a with like a wide generational sort of, I don't know, range of people. Like, they're just, we're making, you know, songs about faith. We're like a real Christian band, which sounds so awesome to say to me right now. I just sort of started to think of ourselves as like, that was in the time where all of Christian radio, which we already knew we were never going to get on because we had a prayer, but all of it was becoming really like worship music. And there was less and less like Michael W. Smith type bands where they're making like genuine Christian music. It's about faith. It's to sort of like nurture your spirit or encourage you or challenge you. But it wasn't always just songs only for Sunday morning. And so that's kind of how I started to see us, is like, and that is again, that is the same. It's a punk attitude of, I don't want to become, nothing wrong with all these other bands, but I don't want to just be like Christians in a band, because that's sort of everyone. Like, I mean, the amount of times I read that in articles from a teenager on was just like infinite. Oh, well, we don't call ourselves a Christian band. We're just Christians in a band. It was like, how unoriginal and boring is that?
At one point, that was an edgy
It was an edgy
to break,
thing.
And then it became
ubiquitous. But you
got to
understand, I grew up where that was what everyone said.
Right.
So it's not edgy to me at all. The edgy thing is like, can you actually like maintain a worship attitude where you're really spiritually trying to do this in a way that's from a worshipful spirit and be more creative than whatever Switchfoot at the same time? Is that possible? And that was sort of like the dichotomy I was trying to pull, is like, can I push beyond the limits of these other bands and have it not, I don't want to say like more Christian, because that's not a real thing. I just mean with the like original intention of, I'm making this to work out faith or feed my faith and do the, and that's what it'll do for other people. Mm-hmm. Not just making like just fun songs because they're fun, you know?
Yeah. And then that takes you all the way into doing what I consider to be the farthest away from church music, a mixtape, you know, the Beauty Between, which is just, that's just pop art in some sense, what's done there, but it's still coming from the same place. So that's like a pendulum swing all the way into some other territory. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's got all the collaborations, and that was a, you know, a big project. And then Sticks and Stones being the biggest song on that, and it's like a song you hear on the Lexus commercial during the NBA playoffs all of a sudden, like that
yeah.
was that. So that song out of that project, how do you think of that as a distance travel from the beginning?
Well, that record was really fast. I made it really fast. And to be honest, I made it because we needed money. I made it because my wife and I were like running out of money. And so I made it fast because I was out of the Tooth and Nail deal. And I knew if I put it out quick, I could start getting monthly payments from TuneCore, which does not sound artistic and genuine, but that was a real thing.
Well, it's
it was an aside.
It's a part of DIY. It's one of the reasons why your setup is so good, is because that ownership of your IP, that's something the previous generation hasn't had.
Right.
And it's really, I think it's really important people understand that you own basically all of your music. Oh, not entirely all of it, but almost all of it you own.
Yeah.
And that is a way to, that is like kind of the funding mechanism to mm-hmm. keep everything going.
Yeah. And so, you know, that project had that, there was that sort of writing underneath it, which was a nuts and bolts thing, like a real life thing. But it was also all right, we did two records, and the last record, With a Prayer on it, was really heavy, and I just kind of want a break. And I grew up DJing, and I am, you know, meeting Andy and all these other Christian rappers, Prof and stuff. So it just felt native. Like, why don't I just do a mixtape as like a side? Like, for a while, it wasn't even going to be released as King's Kaleidoscope. It was just Chad the producer doing experimental, like, alternative hip hop production. Mm-hmm. I'll sing choruses. I'm going to send a bunch of tracks out and get a bunch of like rap verses. And it ended up, yeah, being like our most successful release. Maybe because it was just so free spirited. But yeah, Sticks and Stones is the biggest song without any rapper on it. So it also. Right.
But the, I mean, those songs with the rappers are, I mean, the whole thing works together, but it's just far away from Come Thou Fail all the way to those collaborations.
And when I made, the thing I remember most about that is when I remember, like, my parents are always listening to my demos, and then I sent them like the masters, and then they listen to it. And when I sent the whole thing to my mom, her reaction was, "You're sounding more like yourself." And that was like great encouraging feedback, because I was nervous, like, well, the sound has been Chad plus, you know, 10 church volunteers to make this orchestral pop rock thing. And I just did two records like that, more or less, where I'm producing with that sort of framework. And all of a sudden now I'm producing more of it myself. I'm bringing people into the studio maybe a little bit more one at a time, although I had been doing that, but, you know, it just, it was more collaborative with the rappers and then the artist who did all the artwork, Tobias, which I really love that side of it too, all the visuals, but it was a little less collaborative with the instrumentation, like the band members, not a ton, but a little bit. And so I was worried about that, like feeling less genuine. But then my mom, when she said, you know, this is sounding more like you. And I know that, and you always told me this, like over time, if you take a church thing and it becomes a real band, it's not going to be the same people. Like the people in the thing are going to change, because it wasn't all their dream to be in a band called King's Kaleidoscope and make this specific music, you know? And so that record was when we shifted the most personnel. And I sort of fully embraced the, like, this is my production style. This is how I cut my teeth as a kid making beats and DJing, but then also going to church and getting as many people to play strings and whatever as possible. And it's a marriage of those two things. And that's what it'll be going forward. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so at that point, you come to more realization of how independent, you know, just that. You know, there's this whole thing where it felt like, is King's going to get some big major label deal and go big, big, big? And then the trajectory turns out to be more one of the most independent type of bands.
Yeah, I mean, we've always... The thing that's different about us than probably most all the other Tooth and Nail bands with sort of this Christian and punk thing together is that we've never had a wave that we've been a part of. I mean, you could say that the church thing was a wave to launch us, but it was so short, you know, and that's not a pipeline that was just consuming tons of music as music fans. It was like, well, we can use this at our church maybe. So it's a different thing, but because of that, we've never had this surge where, like, even though Sticks and Stones is like our big song, it's not like a big song in the scope of what most bands have at this point 10 years in. And so because we never have had that sort of, like, you know, rocket to the moon moment, there's never had a viral moment, never had a single anything, we always have had this feeling after each project of like, well, that was pretty good for being DIY, but man, we might just need a big label. And so we were like always sort of like having those conversations and like sniffing around that stuff, but it just never felt right. What we would have had to give up for it never felt like we would get back what we have in return. And maybe that is just because of the art we make. Like, maybe it's more niche than we want to realize, but that niche is bigger than we want to realize. And it's just our job to keep, you know, serving it, and that might just be it.
And from the beginning, the direct connection to the fans is a thing that major label artists don't often have. They usually come from some big thing and then get a bunch of fans, and it's mass and wide. But your fan connection is the very deep type.
Yeah, so it's always,
like,
the, like,
as long as you can go direct, It's right. like, how much of this should we ever farm out or give away?
Right.
And it seems like there's probably some help you could get out there.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
at the same time, that would take away from something that is already there.
Yeah, it could. And yeah, we have the kind of band that's like more hours listened than listeners or whatever. You know, people, I think it's hard to really know, but I think there is a general use that the utility of King's Kaleidoscope is like, I have a whole album that they put out and it came to me within in a hard time of my life or when there was a big change going on. And I really like use the album to get through it. And that there's a lot of bands that do that. We definitely are one of them. We are not we put out a single and it was like fun for the summer. And then we couldn't wait for the next single to come out. Every time we put out singles, it just feels like our fans are just kind of waiting for the album.
You know? It's these deeper things.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And so Zeal is definitely a deeper adventure into something. Chasing the shadow, wasting the battle, changing the channel. Now all the fuss is just fade without the rush. Remember what it felt like to believe. Remember running wild and living free. Remember when the magic was a mystery. Now all the fuss is just fade without the rush.
Wait. Yeah, Zeal's the most like tight concept that we've ever had from front to back. Same thing with that sort of contrarian energy. It was like, all right, all these mega churches, including ours, imploded, and now everybody is tearing apart in a good ways, the sort of their religious foundation that wasn't so healthy. But like, are they throwing away this, like the beautiful, true sweetness of faith? And, so yeah, I could summarize that. Can I swear on this or no? Okay. I summarized that by like on my monitor screen for that whole making of the album, I had two pieces of tape and written on the tape. One was fuck CCM and the other one was fuck spiritual apathy. And it was like that. If you could say what King's Kaleidoscope is in a way, that's what it is. It's like, I don't want to become a Colony House, which is a sick band. I love them. But that's not what King's Kaleidoscope should be. King's Kaleidoscope is like 100% full on challenging faith for the believer in a blatant, obvious, you know what I mean? Like I keep saying, like Michael W. Smith way, that's just what it is. So there's no like sort of, that's a bad example of Colony House because they're not apathetic, but whatever band that you could say that is where they just become a regular band. Like I didn't want to do that. But I also do not want to just become, I don't want to fall into like the money trap of, well, if you would just do a hymns album, if you would just do, you know, like write simpler music, like if your drums aren't so crazy, then maybe we can get you on Christian radio. Like I'm not interested in that either, right? So it's kind of both of those things at once.
Yeah. And that by that time you've been around so long that you've influenced many other artists and, you know, you're like a well-known thing. You have a whole bus tour with a full production on Zeal. Does that feel like a highlight, like an accomplishment?
I mean, it felt like, yeah, it felt like a huge deal, but also like it felt, I just felt behind the eight ball a little bit because I like stumbled into this being my career. And my first bus tour is when I turned 30, right before the tour. So that also is kind of weird where you're like, all my peers now have been doing this for basically a decade. So I felt really behind the eight ball of like, oh man, like can I still be successful at this if I'm starting my first bus tour? My first tour period when I'm 26, and then my first bus tour like when I turned 30. But it also did feel, and it still does, it feels too big to sort of give up on. You know, like if I ever feel now like, well, you know, we had our run and we hit like the ceiling of that niche is interested in, it's also like, but dang it, like 1,300 tickets in at House of Blues in Orange County is like pretty good with no label and you know, like $100 on Instagram ads. Like, that's a good, like, I guess there's still a demand here, even though it doesn't feel like it on the Spotify side, maybe, or on the social media side. Like, I think this is still a thing.
Now, I just perceive that as like you came in a generation where you were leapfrogged. You came in as like, oh, it's easy. We're already here. And now you've seen another generation come in and just be like,
way bigger.
Straight to big on Spotify or straight to big on Instagram.
It's basically like TikTok. Yeah. TikTok will like trump all of that. But I do wonder, and I don't even, I mean, who knows? It's just, I'm just curious about it. Like, if you have a viral moment on Instagram or Reels or whatever, and you're a more of like an influencer musician, and then you go to do your first tour, which is what's happening a lot right now, I just wonder how much they're going to want to keep touring, because, or like assemble a band and tour, because they can just sit at home and make a lot more money just creating the content.
Very different challenge.
But I can't, but like that's never going to be.
No map. There's no map for it.
There's no map.
It's kind of interesting to see what might happen, though.
It is like, very interesting.
It might be worse, but it might be new or something.
But all I'm saying is like, I haven't really pivoted, and I probably will never pivot to be more of like a content creator. It's just not my, I'm not really interested in it. But I do hope that some of the content creators like, sort of realize like, it's easier to just make money from home.
What's the difference?
And it's not so hard for us to book venues and all that stuff. Sure. You know, because if you're just like a band right now, there's a lot more people that are quote unquote artists running around. That's kind of cool, I guess, if they're connecting with fans.
Is the line between artist and content creator in a way that's exclusive? Like, what is that line of somebody who's a content creator, but you're not that?
I just think it's probably more playing the game of the technology. It's like playing a technology. It's like playing, it's like where you know that you're playing the algorithm game is the art form.
Is the art form, yeah, right? So it's the which labeling
is,
of
which
the
is,
art form.
Which can be really cool. Like there's people that do it. There's people that do it where I'm like, that is so corny, in the same way that people usually would play a traditional, let's say like CCM industry. But then there's other people that do it and it's like, I like it. It has a, like you are being really creative with how you use the algorithm.
It's a different game.
It's different game.
But the game that
it's
you
not
come
a right,
from is
it's
still
not
a
right
record
music.
Sales like fundamental. The master recordings are the fundamental art form, not the
the songs. Thing. The 100 hours into the Rush being like a 9.5 minute thing with an orchestra from Budapest. Like that's my art form, and it might not be what culture continues to want or is like valuable, but it's definitely the one that I like. It's not that I want to stop learning, but it feels native to me. It feels emotional to me. Mm-hmm. So why would I start doing something that is less emotional to connect in an emotional?
It's like a deep world building part that's not necessarily what is incentivized on 15-second clip world.
Totally. Like the 15-second clip thing can be really sick. Like I keep saying, but I just don't think that's ever going to be like the thing that I really get off on.
The modern paradigm would have to be that you're doing that, like Mr. Beast does all these crazy things. And then, of course, there's clips like of the meta of the making of it could make something. But the doing, building the deeply connected worlds that are super long form is still more that, you know, that's a different
mindset. I'm just kind of like slow and methodical. And I like artists that release the least amount of music with the longest gaps in between. That's who I appreciate them more, which is completely antithetical to, like, if I could afford it, we would release less music, which, I mean, how wild is that?
Yeah.
But I just would, that is what I prefer. I don't think people can handle it that much stuff. Same with TV shows, like movies, like all that. Just like, all I want every year is like one amazing movie and I'll watch it like 3 times. I don't need like a ton. Same with albums. Like, if I can just absorb 2 excellent albums a year, that's really all I can handle with how, like, you know, oversaturated life is right now. So I don't need to be hearing from my favorite artist every other year, even.
Or 3-4 times a day.
No, but exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, I only need a Kendrick Lamar album every 4 years, and that's great. Mm-hmm. And maybe if he wants to quit after 6 records, that's sick. Those things are perfect. They're gems. You know, I'll find in the next artist.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of how content. That's what I'm saying. It's just the opposite about how a lot of artists right now would think about how what their game is. Mm-hmm. I'm just not really interested in it.
And so you do the Zeal tour. So you finally, at least the good news is you finally get to where you're doing a bus tour. Maybe you say it's late and you come home and there's money from that. You buy a house and you have kids and do all that stuff and you finally make it. And then it's like, oh, I can just do a bunch of big bus tours now and with no problems, right?
You wish it was that easy. No, I mean, just like for so many other people, like the pandemic stuff just sucked because we came off of that Zeal tour with like, yeah, more money than we'd ever had and tons of momentum, ready to go back out for another run. And then we just couldn't do anything for like a year. And that sucked. But what we ended up doing was somebody really generous helped us get basically it's like a retreat center. And it's this old studio that was built by a band in the 70s and like a huge house. And I just would fly the band in and we'd create our own little bubbles. So basically for like that year and a half when everything was shut down or, you know, in various states of shutdown, we just created what we called Camp Kaleidoscope. And we're about to put out the third project from that time period.
There's a lot of, if you include the streaming events, those were big deals too.
That's
projects
true.
That came out of that.
Yes, we had a Power Perfect EP, which mm-hmm. It's just three songs, but it's very potent, more like socially minded, politically minded thing. All hail the god of comfort, convenience, and power. This land is ours, privilege and towers, not for the cowards. Pride of placement adjacent to sacred cows. You wanna fight what's righteous? We had Baptized Imagination, which is like it's a pretty heavy like lament of a album. It's like the whole album of a prayer. And then we have this new one we're about to come out with. But then, yeah, like you said, we also did two live stream events up there that were huge.
Right.
Like they were really big.
They were commercially good. They really spoke to a need in the time when, it's because there was bands that were doing streams early that were not good. And then a few bands, you know, did them well. And you're one of those early
right.
bands.
And then
to
the big budget
out,
bands
well.
Did them like really good.
Yeah.
But for our budget being like almost nothing, I feel like we crushed it.
So EP, two albums, and two
big live streams.
And both those live streams are like full record mixes. They take all the resources, it's full recording.
Well, I would put it this way.
A ton of work.
Like both those live streams combined, we grossed almost the same amount of the entire Zeal tour. So 2 weekends of having like big live stream events was almost as good for the business as a month long being on the road. Mm-hmm. Which takes a lot of work to prep those and shoot them and stuff. But you know what I'm saying? Like that. But that was, I don't think you can do that anymore. But for that time, it definitely felt like we made the right move. I'm really like, whatever we were thinking like was right because it floated us for not being on a tour for, 2 years.
And then the two albums that come out of it, if there's more to say about what the journey is from, like basically from here, you go to that very lamentful Baptized Imagination that came out last year. So yeah. What that is, all the way to the release that is, coming out now. So that in itself is another whole journey or transformation again.
Basically, like, in that time period up at Camp Kaleidoscope, we went up there, I think, 5 or 6 times. And you have all the guys in the band are, their life is just weird for everybody in the whole world. But then we're in these bubbles where we're living together and there's two things simultaneously happening, which is represented in these two albums. And one is that that pandemic basically forced everybody to stop everything and deal with their demons, right? So everybody's up at camp having all these, you know, really vulnerable conversations, and we're pushing each other and we're talking to each other and we're, you know, stuff's coming out of the woodwork. So for me, that was Baptized Imagination, which was really me getting into like, all right, I've had this anxiety disorder my whole life. What does it actually mean? Where does it come from? And I'm, for the first time in my life, really digging into like chemically what's going on with me. And then I'm doing different types of therapy. I'm like really trying to figure out, can I fix this? What does that mean? God, you know, are you going to help me fix this and heal or not? But everybody else in the band had their other different things that were going on. Well, let's say we documented my sort of journey with that, with Baptized Imagination. But then this next record that's coming out is that other simultaneous side of, well, shit, we're in a mansion and we have 10 days here and we can play basketball and go bowling and ride around on scooters and play music in the studio till 1 a.m. every night if we want to, and, you know, play in the pool, and like we're having so much fun, and there's these pockets of joy that we all desperately need right now, because we're all sort of like facing pretty heavy stuff. And all those pockets of joy weren't found because we had like this mansion, but they were found because, you know, we had a, once again, a free space.
Environment echoes the early church thing.
Yeah. Just like a free space to where everybody can be themselves and we can be together. And so yeah, then this next record, like almost the whole thing is interpersonal versus like, you know, talking to God sort of lyrics. It's all encouragement and yeah, like relational songs, like person to person, friend to friend. Mm-hmm. And that's very new for us. Like we've never, that actually feels like the farthest thing from the stuff way back that I grew up doing, where I was singing, you know, writing or arranging songs for church, because, you know, even writing songs about faith, it does feel like worship leading in a way where you're like, all right, let's put our minds on God. And now this is the first album where there's a lot of songs that are there. They have this undercurrent of faith weaving the people together, in I think almost all the songs, but they really are like conversational person to person, which is really new for us.
Yeah. So the environment thing is big there, in that it's like something is very deep in the thing that's in common with these places where you are both encouraged and pushed.
Yep.
And, you know, you have the freedom to experiment in, yep, in a closed and deep environment.
Yep.
Like those conditions are very special.
Yeah, they are.
They're very special conditions to create.
Yeah.
And part of the culture is to put, I mean, and don't, you know, that in a church, it, that's what a church does, if, especially if it's doing it right.
If it's doing it right.
It has to be pushing and it has to be encouraging, you know.
It's got to be both. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would say that actually maybe that's what I feel the most happy or like joyful about, is just creating the conditions. Right? Like my role in the band isn't to be the best musician. I'm not. Like for any one of the people's given instruments, they're better at them than I am at singing. But my job is to create conditions where we can sort of be experimental and pretty free. And then I become the collage artist that takes all the stuff that's created. And maybe that's my greatest skill, is the stubborn sort of collaging of like things that shouldn't work together, making them work together. Yeah, that's but probably
the quality of musicians that you play with is high, and you push and put demands on them too that are felt as like pushing. Like
they do, they feel like
it's not
harder.
Just encouragement either. You also, there's another side.
And it
to
doesn't
that.
Necessarily mean like play me something like technically harder. It means like, yeah, you're right. I just like pushing people. Like if they're comfort, I try to push them outside their comfort zone.
It's that.
You know, like especially, I would say the way that the pushing on this next album, we've talked about this a little bit, is like I'm pushing, I'm toying with corniness. I'm toying with like perceived like corniness. So like if John says like, oh my gosh, like bass chords are just always corny, or slap bass is always corny, I'll make him do it, you know, and I'm going to make a way that it feels right. Or if like a lyric is just like the dumbest lyric you could sing, I will make it work in the context of the song so that it feels right. Like I have some really quote unquote bad lyrics that are very intentional because they're supposed to throw you off and go, wow, my, like, why do I, like, why would I think that's dumb? It's just a real thing you would say. Or maybe some of that comes from having kids too, where there's just no pretense really. Maybe that's what it is. You know, I'm trying to like push against some of the pretentiousness that maybe I've even had, you know?
Yeah. And it seems like the way that can, those environments and conditions have to be, the core of it is it has to be high trust.
Yeah.
To be vulnerable enough to do the hard pushing and the encouragement and all that. It has to be in a deep.
Yeah. You got to, yeah. Like creating the environment within our sort of band and then extended camp that be whoever you are and talk about it openly and you're going to be fully accepted. And then you're also going to be fully like challenged at the same time. And if you're down for that, then that's what we're all agreeing to, you know? Mm. Which is good. I mean, I think that's, what else do you want from like relationships? You know what I mean? Because yeah. One way or the other is just too much. You got to have both, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so now there's a, this album is out soon, mm-hmm. relatively soon. It's coming out. So, and then there's a tour. Does the album have a name? With the final name of the album?
We haven't decided.
We're turning it in right now. So, that you know?
I have 4 days to turn it in. I don't know yet.
No,
isn't that bad?
No, it's not bad. You'll know eventually.
It was going to be a self-titled album. I can talk about this. I thought it was going to be the self-titled album because it's, we had been simmering in this, like, we're going to camp. We've had the most community. We've had the most consistent group of people around it. The sort of characteristics of who we are and like our culture have sort of risen to the forefront in a lot of ways. It's interpersonal. It's self. Like it's self-reflective in a lot of ways. So it was like, oh, this is the album that describes King's Kaleidoscope. We should self-title it. It makes sense. It's not just doing it to do it. It actually like makes sense. But the only thing is that as the album has been finessed and finalized, it's really only one of the aspects of King's Kaleidoscope, which is the like the joyful, encouraging, like silly sort of pockets of who we are, the free pockets of who we are. That's awesome. But if I title it King's Kaleidoscope, I would also want it to have the gamut of like emotions, which if you look at our other catalog, like most of it is pretty, you know, there's a lot of wrestling in it and there's a lot of heavier stuff. So I just, the longer I sat with self-titled and then only like the happy songs made the album, I was like, ah, I don't know if this is just the like, unequivocally like clear King's Kaleidoscope stamp.
So you've labeled as interpersonal and happy.
Yes.
So you've already framed it as the happiest King's
Kaleidoscope. It is. It's like, man, that was a really heavy like hang in the hot tub, guys. Like, should we go whatever? Like, I don't know. Like, should we go back to the studio and just like play a country song for fun? Like it's that energy where we're just, it's a little more like manic and free and just fun. Yeah.
Which is nice after the journey. It is. And everything else.
Right. But yeah, titling it is a little tricky. I have an idea, but I'm not going to say it.
And it feels good. Summertime and big tour. The tour's going everywhere.
Huge tour. The biggest tour.
It's the biggest thing. I mean, you did one last year, but this one's even more expansive, longer.
Yeah. Last year was the like, coming out of that first Big Zeal tour and then everything shut down and then it'll be in a lot of pent up. Well, when are we going to get another one? And then we did it and it was awesome. And yeah, you know, sold a lot more tickets than we ever had, which surprised me actually. I kind of thought it would have just been the same And then this year is like, I don't know. I guess it's just like, are we just going to keep doing this? I don't know. I just, every one of them feels, all the way from the first album, it just feels like an experiment. Like if it goes really bad, I'll reconsider. But I guess it's just still there. Like people want to come and sing with us. And I think there is something that's spiritually intentional about our shows that is different enough from church. And, but the shows are also like entertaining and, but that's different enough than just a regular show. And so I think there's just like a special, we have a special groove that is hard to find a lot of places.
Yeah. And so across your career, it's interesting too. You don't necessarily have the phenomenon, oh, the first record was the good one or the first two or anything. You have a very even across time.
People like all different records for all different reasons.
Yeah.
Because they're all different. And that, I also think that's important, if I could like pull back the curtain, is that, you know, you do something that works and then I don't ever just want to repeat it. You know, I want to push myself or just try a new thing, you know, and also like life changes, you know what I mean? Like I'm not writing sort of generic enough lyrics and songs that I can just kind of keep retooling the same sort of like angle on music. Like I'm basically time stamping what I'm going through in, you know, as realistically as I can and honestly as I can. And then that's what the music is. So why do we have a fun, like silly album coming out? Well, cause we had a lot of fun in the middle of a lot of, you know, shit while we were at camp, and we made a lot of songs and they're just sitting there. So why not share them, you know?
And then what makes that next after that though? You got any insight?
I have just the most like burning desire for the last, literally since Zeal. So this is like, we're almost going to be at like 3 years now to do a record that will be singable in churches. Not everything, but like we could still go crazy with the, like, I'm not going to franchise this musically where it's crazy musically, but I want to at least be able to like have an album where there's like songs you can sing at church with chord charts in a simple version, and that's part of the whole idea. Just a full-on, like, very intentional worship album that churches could use.
And that originally was what you were trying to not do. I feel like you said that at the beginning, that you were trying to make sure it's not franchisable.
Just the music side of it. And this will still be that. Like, you won't be able to franchise the musicianship, ideally. But I will still go.
The setting.
Here's
is
the melody, and the melody and the lyric is easy enough that you can just make your own music to it. And here's the chords.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying?
And there'll be a King's Classical version. The setting of church is a set. Singing.
I think so.
Yeah, that seems to always be the heart. Even that when you go to the club shows, whatever the sound and style of music is, it's a deep attention where everybody's on the exact same wavelength. Because that's what's so different about it than rock shows. At rock shows, there is a more divided attention most of the time, where there's people talking and people into the pit and But at King shows, it's more unified, where it's everybody on the almost the exact same focus wavelength, and they are there to actually sing. They're doing singing.
Right, like, which is the church DNA thing that's cool, but because people would go to, you know, people are going to like a Hillsong at a festival to worship, and they have that same attention, but we're in a sense doing a similar thing with just completely different musicianship and types of song arrangements and all that. You know what I mean? Like it's a, God, I hate that I'm saying this because I don't like musical theater very much, but I'll tell you a quick story. But like, but all I was going to say is, well, what I'm getting to is it's almost like going to a theater production. And the reason I hate saying that is because I don't like musical theater. But the reason I think this is because we went and opened for this band called Lawrence, and they're awesome. They're great. And we were trying to figure out, like, what is the similarity between us and a soul pop band like this that's pretty successful. And one of the guys in the band was like, well, dude, Chad, you're pretty theatrical. Like, you're pretty, you know, you're the way you write, the arrangements, like it's pretty theatrical. I think it's like theater music nerd kids. He just said that as an aside, and I hated it because I don't like musical theater. But it's been like a year since he said that, and I kind of can't get away from it. We're almost like a theater production Christian punk band of some sort. You know what I mean? If you think about the music and the types of song, like A Prayer, we talk about that song.
Theatrical Christian.
That song is a drama.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Isn't that what it is? It's not like a rock song. It's like a drama, like of some kind.
Yeah,
you know?
Drama is a, it's is like a play. Word, right?
Yeah. And I think we have a lot of that in our music that I've come to like realize and accept. Yeah.
Theatrical Christian punk.
Right. So dumb. But yeah, sure, whatever. Christian rock. That's just want to be called a Christian rock band forever. Until it's not. Well, I guess if that gets cool, then I'll go back to we're just Christians in a band. I'll just keep flip-flopping.
Yeah, you'll get that. Yeah. Come back around.
Right.
All right. I don't have anything else. You?
No, that's it. This is great. Don't dance with the devil in D. Hold hands with the powers that be. No chance with the feeling ain't free. One mind, one body, one speed. All right. Hold the other.